All right, tax case number three. Case number 25-11382, Andrew Filipowski versus the Commissioner. Mr. Laser.
Good morning. May it please the court. Tom Laser, joined by my colleague, Adam Fain, for the appellant, Andrew Filipowski. This case concerns the appellee, the Commissioner of Internal Revenue's rejection of Mr. Filipowski's offer to compromise an outstanding tax liability, and the U.S. tax court's decision to sustain that rejection by entering summary judgment for the commissioner. The U.S. tax court committed reversible error in sustaining the commissioner's rejection for two reasons. First, the tax court overlooked genuinely disputed material facts or failed to construe facts in Mr. Filipowski's favor in violation of the summary judgment standard. And second, the tax court erred in finding that the commissioner's rejection of Mr. Filipowski's offer was not an abuse of discretion, primarily because the commissioner's rejection lacked sound basis in fact and law and was arbitrary.
Okay, let's talk about that last point first. Again, this is from a very far out perspective, but it's just an initial instinctive reaction. The IRS determined, rightly or wrongly, that your client owed $140 million or so in taxes, right?
At the time of the offer, that was the approximate number, yes.
Right. Okay, so that's what the IRS is thinking, $140 million in taxes. Even in today's world, that's a big number. Your client offers to compromise for $1.5 million. That's like not in the galaxy. And I know you have other legal issues, and we're gonna take those up one by one. But you seem to say throughout your brief or suggest that the IRS had no choice but to accept a compromise offer for $1.5 million on a purported $140 million tax liability. This is not like I'm paying 50% or I'm paying 25% or I'm paying 33%. It's like, I haven't done the math, but it's like less than 1%. And you're saying that there's an abuse of discretion and there's no sound basis for the IRS to reject that compromise offer. Tell me why that's just not wrong. Why can't the IRS rationally say, we are not accepting 1% on the dollar, less than 1% on the dollar?
Your Honor, we understand that the sheer optics of this case can be difficult to grapple with. And we also understand that at the commissioner's level and at the tax court level, the standard was very discretionary toward the commissioner. But we believe that this case does present an opportunity to find that Mr. Filipowski's offer was reasonable and should have been accepted under the circumstances.
But let me ask you a question. I mean, at some point, the IRS determined even that his reasonable collection potential was close to $6 million, right? And he owed a tremendous amount in taxes. He did not contest that his reasonable collection potential was close to $6 million. He said he'd be open to compromising the debt for that reasonable collection potential. And that reasonable collection potential is, you know, like almost four times as much as what his offer and compromise was. So even if we take out of the equation what he originally owed, why is it an abuse of discretion, given all of those facts? Plus, I haven't even mentioned that he and his wife made about $30,000 a month, and he appeared to have engineered a friendly lien to avoid taxes. When you take into account all of those things, why was it an abuse of discretion? That is, that it was just so out of the realm of possible answers here that were reasonable for the IRS commissioner to have rejected the $1.5 million offer and compromise?
I'll take the questions in turn because they are related, and an explanation of both will help flesh everything out. The compromise rules exist because of the sheer fact that, despite the fact that in an ideal world, everyone would timely pay their taxes in full when they are due. But that obviously does not exist, and that is why the compromise rules exist. The compromise rules require consideration of the government's interest in collecting as much as possible and not leaving the taxpayer so destitute that they cannot afford basic living expenses. Here, as the record shows, and I don't believe there's really much of a dispute in the record, that Mr. Filipowski's net worth has been reduced dramatically over time. due to what I'll characterize as bad business investments from the time that he earned this income in 1999 through when the liability was assessed in 2017, and as far as I know, all the way through when he submitted his offer. So for that reason, we believe that this case presents an instance where, despite, yes, the liability to offer ratio, the circumstances do warrant meaningful consideration if that wasn't done. And addressing Judge Rosenbaum's question as to why there was an abuse of discretion, an abuse of discretion can occur where there are where there is a determination that is rendered without sound basis in fact.
What do we make of the fact that counsel said he'd be open, that Mr. Filipowski would be open to settling for his reasonable collection potential, which was determined at close to $6 million?
So at the negotiation stage, counsel for Mr. Filipowski, who's incidentally Mr. Fain, who's here today, had wanted to discuss with IRS counsel the reasonable collection potential, but by the time they got to discussing reasonable collection potential, the IRS revenue officer had already made it abundantly clear that they were going to be denying Mr. Filipowski's offer on public policy. There was really, therefore, no need to go into reasonable collection
right.
potential.
But the problem is, if he were willing to settle or compromise it for close to $6 million, why in the world would it be an abuse of discretion for the IRS commissioner to reject a claim for an offer to compromise for a quarter of that?
Well, Judge, if I may, I don't believe that it was ever communicated that Mr. Filipowski would settle at that reasonable collection potential figure of the $5.9 million or somewhere close to it. I believe the concession that perhaps Your Honor is referring to occurred at the summary judgment hearing before the tax court, where my colleague was asked whether or not Mr. Filipowski would consider increasing his offer. And all that was conveyed was, we would consider it. And then a reminder to the court that we really never got to discussing the numbers because the revenue officer made it very clear that they were going to be rejecting on public policy grounds.
But it's not just a $1.5 million offer. It's that Mr. Filipowski, for maybe good reason on his part, wasn't going to pay that immediately, not even in a couple of years. Like, over how many decades was the $1.5 million supposed to be spread out in his offer?
I believe the offer was approximately 23 months at $1,000 a month, with the remaining balance of 1.4 something million paid in the 24th month. If I remember the revenue officer's notes correctly, I believe it was about a 2-year time frame, not a decades long time frame, Your Honor.
And how is he supposed to, if he was telling the IRS he didn't have the money, how's he going to pay $1.4 million in 2 years?
Well, despite the fact that he does have Parkinson's disease, so his ability to earn future income is somewhat in jeopardy, as are his potential living expenses associated with that disease, you know, he has been able to collect, you know, a modest salary and use that to live a very modest life. So he does collect income, and I believe, you know, his offer of $1.5 million was well warranted.
How much does he have? How much does he, when at the negotiation stage, what does the record reflect about how much he had in liquid assets?
In liquid assets, well, the IRS came to this $5.9 million figure. I don't know whether the calculations were fully relayed at that time, but my recollection of the record is that he had approximately $3.1 million in a Roth IRA with Merrill Lynch, and then virtually no other assets, no real estate. And this also isn't a case where Mr. Filipowski is out in the French Riviera on a yacht. He lives in a 2-bedroom apartment that his girlfriend owns. He doesn't own fancy cars. This is not like in the Hauptmann case, which is cited in the briefs, where the taxpayer has like a private chef or makes big charitable donations. Mr. Filipowski lives a very modest life. So his offer of 1.5 was in good faith. And despite the fact that, yes, his ability to earn income is jeopardized, he does have medical expenses and needs, you know, money to live a basic and...
How do you factor in, if at all, the matter with the DePasquale Trust and the standstill agreement?
So this is an area where we believe that the IRS particularly abused its discretion because they seem to have misunderstood the facts regarding the trust and how it was created. The trust was created by an individual not related to Mr. Filipowski, but who I understand he used to do business with. It appears that this individual saw that Mr. Filipowski was underwater, facing massive judgments, having been highly leveraged in real estate at the time of the financial crisis. And this person reached out to, on their own volition or through a representative, to the banks that held those judgments against Mr. Filipowski and decided to buy those judgments from the banks. Now, I want to make clear that this did not alter the bank's lien position or the IRS's. It really just substituted in the trust for the banks.
And what did, how many cents on the dollar?
I'm not familiar with the exact math, Your Honor, and I don't think that that's in the record. I do believe that the trust bought the judgments at a discount, which is standard practice in the judgment purchasing and enforcement.
No, of course it is. I understand it is, and I'm not suggesting it's inappropriate. I'm just, but I want to know the number. I want to know the number, because that reduced, given the standstill agreement, that reduced Mr. Filipowski's liabilities significantly, at least the immediate payment responsibilities.
I will address that, Your Honor, and the reason I don't have the answer is because it's not in the record, and the reason it's not in the record is because Mr. Filipowski is not really affiliated with the trust. He didn't create it. He's not a trustee. He's not a beneficiary. The trust has leaned some of his assets.
Who entered into the standstill agreement?
The standstill agreement, I don't believe, was a written agreement. I don't think it was anything formal. I think it was just a way.
Agreement has to be between one person or entity on one side and one entity or person on the other. So the trust is on the one end forbearing, and who's on the other end?
The record reflects that it's between the trust and Mr. Filipowski.
So he had transaction, he had communications with them, and he had dealings with them. And so this also looks like it is just a very, very favorable way of helping Mr. Filipowski, because how in the world does the trust benefit from purchasing that debt if it's not going to get paid on the debt, aside from maybe a tax write-off at some point?
I see that my time is soon to expire, so I will answer your question, but then I'll conclude after that. It's beneficial to the trust because they've been able to lien Mr. Filipowski's assets and collect on those. In the record, I believe there's a bank statement, and this is noted in Mr. Fain's, one of his letters to the IRS revenue officer, that there was a distribution from an LLC that Mr. Filipowski had invested in. I think the amount was about $200,000. That did not go to Mr. Filipowski. That went to the trust. The trust also has a lien on Mr. Filipowski's life insurance policy, just in case Mr. Filipowski were to pass away, the trust would be able to collect. So the trust is, in fact, benefiting. For these reasons, Your Honors, we ask that the court vacate and reverse the tax court's entry of summary judgment for the commissioner. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You've saved all your time for rebuttal, Mr. Laser. Ms. Del Sol.
Good morning. May it please the court, Ellen Del Sol for the Commissioner of Internal Revenue. The tax court here correctly held that the IRS Appeals Office did not abuse its discretion in rejecting this $1.5 million proposed settlement on public policy grounds, because it correctly concluded that accepting the offer would have a negative impact on compliance by the general public. In reviewing that decision of the tax court, this court's role is simply to take a fresh look at whether there's an abuse of discretion. And as the Eighth Circuit said in the 50 Below case cited in our brief, this is a very deferential review that would require reversal only if there was a very clear unfairness, abuse of discretion, or unreasonableness on the IRS's part. And I think, as Judge Jordan pointed out, the optics here make clear that this case is definitely a case where it clearly would have been against public policy to accept this settlement, because it would have impacted the general public. These settlements through the Officers in Compromise, through the Office of Appeals, are open to the public under 6103K3, so it's not something that wouldn't be seen by the public. And this is a situation where it would be a penny on the dollar compromise if the IRS were to accept this. And certainly, given Mr. Filipowski's history of noncompliance, that creates a situation where the general public would I think look askance at having to pay their taxes when he's being able to just to get $110 million in
income.
Can
I ask you a question about how this process works when an offer is made?
Yes, Sean.
Does the IRS just take offers as they are made and evaluate them and reject them or accept them, or is there a give and take where the IRS might say, well, we're rejecting that offer, we think it's way too low, but we will accept an offer of compromise of, you know, three times your initial offer? Does that happen, or does the IRS just say, nope, that's just too low, come back to us with another one if you want?
I think, Your Honor, what you can see in the record here, the administrative record's quite voluminous here and shows there was a lengthy exchange between the appeals office, actually a couple of appeals officers who, as they turned over time, and Mr. Filipowski's representatives. And it's, and the 6330 hearing is an opportunity to come forward with all the information from the taxpayer and then to make an offer. And I think it does happen that there are revised offers in that process. And I think there was, as you can see in the administrative record, quite a bit of back and forth here. I'm not sure that Mr. Filipowski here ever moved off the $1.5 million offer.
But my question is a more technical one. Like, does the IRS make formal counteroffers, or just say that's too low? If you come up more, we'll think about it.
I think generally the IRS does not make, generally the IRS's employees, and even us as during litigation, can't make offers. But I think there is at least a back and forth discussion that gives a taxpayer some idea of whether they're in the ballpark of what might be reasonable. And I think here...
And was one of those discussions at ballpark was that your liquid assets are $6 point something million?
Well, I think actually that $6 point some million asset, well, I think it was like $5.9 million, Your Honor, but the assets were almost entirely disclosed by Mr. Filipowski. He disclosed that he had $3.4 million in a Roth IRA. He disclosed various bank accounts and other assets and his income, which was coming from the trust and also from his work as a CEO. He was working for another software company, Flory PBC, so that he had fairly substantial six-figure income coming in. And those were assets that he disclosed. And I think it was very clear in this process that this is a collection due this is colloquially known as a collection due process proceeding, where the whole idea is for the IRS to find out what assets you have and then to negotiate a settlement. And the IRS didn't get everything it asked for. It didn't get the information regarding the DePasquale Trust that it asked for. But just on that information that was largely disclosed from Mr. Filipowski himself, it was clear that he could have paid at least that amount. And I think when you look at the history of noncompliance, the source of this income was $110 million that he received in 1999 from sale of a software company. And he entered into what is a now very infamous son of boss transaction that was litigated in the New Millennium trading case that we cited in our briefs. And that shelter was designed to have him pay no tax whatsoever on that $110 million. And he's held this up at litigation, you know, that he litigated through the partnership and now through this proceeding has put off paying any tax whatsoever for over 25 years on that. And I think to take $1.5 million now, when he himself has come up with evidence that he could pay much more than that, the optics of that would really be troubling, and as a matter of public policy, it makes sense. I would just point out that his history of noncompliance doesn't stop there. He also did not file returns in 2015 through 2018 until well past the deadline when the IRS chased him down and inquired about their returns. And beginning in 2017 and 2018, he failed to meet the withholding requirements or to pay estimated taxes. So I think we've got a long history of his not paying that would make this that makes the conclusion eminently reasonable that it would look bad to the general public and make others question their voluntary compliance to see this sort of settlement. My friend mentioned the Parkinson's disease that was brought up at the very end of the proceedings. Mr. Filipowski was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, but he hasn't met his burden of showing that in any way affects his ability to pay or to earn money and then over the next few years, over the proposed settlement terms. Rather, his diagnosis documentation showed that he was walking regularly for exercise, that he was working as a software company CEO and responding well to medication. But of course, the IRS does have extraordinary hardship settlement approaches, which this was not, but in the future, you know, if the time came when he could not pay his medical bills and have a reasonable standard of living, he could submit another offer on those that basis. If the reasonable collection potential, the little details that were in dispute about that, things like his computer share account that was a Canadian account that was something the IRS found on his own, those issues, those little arguments that he made there below, if they've been adequately preserved, really don't move the needle on the amount that he has said he could owe and basically admitted he could pay in terms of his current assets. So I don't think there's any need for the court to get into that. If there are no further questions, we'll rest on our briefs, but I'd be happy to entertain any further questions from the court. Thank you for your time, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. Mr. Laser, can you, in your brief, you argue that the tax court made certain procedural errors, but I can't really figure out from your brief what those procedural errors were. I understand the argument about the disputed issues of fact, and I understand the other arguments in the brief, but like procedurally, I don't know what you think the tax court did wrong.
The procedural.
Can you tell me what those procedural errors were?
Certainly, Judge, and I think you've picked it up. The procedural argument does focus on the disputed facts in the record that weren't given due weight in entering summary judgment for the commissioner, and also certain facts that
I know. But you put that as a separate issue. So your first issue in the brief is the tax court ignored, overlooked disputed issues of material fact, and it shouldn't have granted summary judgment. I understand that argument. But then you have a separate heading, new argument, the tax court committed procedural errors. But I don't know what procedural errors you're talking about, aside from misapplying the summary judgment standard in your view. Like, what else did the tax court do wrong on a procedural note?
I apologize for any confusion in the brief, Judge. I believe we were just trying to refer to the overlooking disputed facts, or perhaps in addition to what Your Honor mentioned, resolving facts in favor of the commissioner rather than Mr. Filipowski.
Okay, so that reference in your brief is to the tax court misapplying the summary judgment standard by overlooking disputed issues of fact or crediting some evidence in favor of the commissioner as opposed to in favor of Mr. Filipowski?
Generally, yes.
Okay, got it. Thank you. You can have your, give him the full rebuttal time, please, Valerie, if you could.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. So, counsel began argument by discussing the fact that the IRS rejected Mr. Filipowski's offer because of the public policy provision. And I want to raise 2 points about that. Courts addressing the IRS's invocation of this public policy provision, they generally look at two factors. You know, will our decision encourage or discourage taxpayers from researching these transactions like tax shelters before entering into them? And what will the general public's perception be of how we treat this offer? And taking those in turn, yes, it is true that the court does not want to set precedent that encourages taxpayers to disregard and not research these transactions, but that doesn't apply here because Mr. Filipowski did exactly that. He engaged qualified professionals, accountants, financial consultants, and he even engaged legal counsel before entering into this transaction. And if you comb through the New Millennium decision, which is the 2017 tax court decision where this transaction was declared avoidable tax shelter, there are no findings of fact regarding Mr. Filipowski's intent. The only findings of fact regarding intent dealt with one of the partnership entities, I believe the name was Shakti, and then the managing member of that entity whose name was Ari Bergman. There's nothing in there indicating that at the time Mr. Filipowski engaged these professionals, he intended to do something illegal. And I will remind the court that he engaged in these transactions in 1999, and they were never declared fully illegal until 2017.
And what do we make, if at all, of the fact that there were certain years in which Mr. Filipowski did not file or pay taxes?
With respect to his 2015 to 2018 returns, Judge, it is true that Mr. Filipowski was technically late in filing his returns for those years, but there are nuances that counsel against characterizing his delinquency as egregious, as the commissioner found. For instance, in 2015, you'll see in the record that Mr. Filipowski's identity was stolen and that he was ultimately entitled a refund for that year. Same with 2016, he was entitled to a refund. So any delay was really to the IRS's benefit. For 2018, yes, he was late, but if you look at the dates, he was only 15 days late. And then looking at all years, 2015 to 2018, by the time he submitted his offer in 2021, he had fully complied with all of his return filing and payment obligations. And I just want to conclude with the point about how the general public could perceive this. It's no secret that the general public is always going to be upset whenever any individual doesn't pay their liabilities in full. But what I'll submit here is that under the circumstances, I think the general public could also be upset to learn that the IRS, rather than accepting a reasonable offer that does comply with the law, refused that offer on principle, and then due to Mr. Filipowski's health condition or basic living expenses, some point down the road, he wasn't able to offer as much. So I don't believe that the public policy provision was entirely properly invoked. And for these reasons, we ask that this court vacate. Thank you.
Right. Thank you both very much. Our last